Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, the shark bait has such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white.
And if you think Mike the Knife was bad, let me tell you, boys and girls of the Milwaukee Mob world, we have with us today probably not only the most intelligent film genius of our lifetime, but the man who's so bad, so vicious when it comes to film conversations, he has gotten the name Ice Pick. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm talking about the famous, the good-looking, the multiple guest star of The Wrong Wheel. We have with us today, the famous, good-looking Martin Kessler. Yay, go you.
Hello. That's quite an introduction. Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome, sir. But before we get into the pre-code area and the code area and all that good stuff, let's have a couple of minutes about what got you interested in doing film, sir.
Sure. I mean, I've sort of always loved film. I'm involved in making film. I love watching and appreciating movies. It's a big, big part of my life.
Absolutely. We can tell. And where can we find you online, sir, before we get to ask?
Probably the best place to find me would be on Twitter at Movie Kessler. And my home podcast, which I co-produce, is the FlixWise Movie Podcast, which delves into the Sight and Sounds list of top 250 greatest films ever made, supposedly. So if you like the sort of movies I'm probably going to be talking about on this show, people might want to check that out.
Outstanding. And are you on Facebook or anything like that, sir?
Not publicly.
Okay. You have the secret identity that we don't want to know about in case the
FBI comes.
I like
to keep my private life separate, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Canadians only always get demand, but they have to know where to look for them first, right?
Right.
So diving in, let's get going. Now, for those people who may not know, one time film used to be very heavily censored, and they came up with something called the Hays Code. Can you explain what that is and how that came about a bit?
Sure. Hays Code was basically a series of restrictions, moral restrictions that films were meant to follow, a code of guidelines that were supposed to keep films from corrupting people morally, I guess, was the basic point. Because Hollywood, I think some people have this image that classic Hollywood was a little bit innocent or naive, but you go back and watch some of the movies from you know, late 20s, early 30s, and they're violent, vulgar, sexy, blasphemous, cynical, energetic, you know, wild stuff, really,
yeah.
Really wild films. And also the image of stars around that time, I mean, you had scandals, like one of the most infamous was Fatty Arbuckles, but there was a whole series that had moral groups, and I think it was the Catholic Legion of Decency demanding a crackdown on Hollywood. So initially, you had Will H. Hays coming in as the president of the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, I think all the way back in 1922, but he was kind of a slack guy. There wasn't really a crackdown on the production code until 1934 with a guy called Joseph Breen, who was a nasty, nasty guy. And that's when you had, you know, instead of gangsters shooting people into Swiss cheese, you had movies about millionaires going down staircases with their top hats. Like, I think often you hear people talk about films during the Great Depression, how, oh, people wanted escapist entertainment. But really, you look at films before 1934, and they're pretty gritty, gritty stuff. People were reflecting on the harshness of real life and the more lurid bits of American culture. So I kind of wonder how much of this escapist entertainment that came later in the 30s had to do more with the moral restrictions than actual audiences flocking to escapist
yes.
entertainment.
I would agree, because to me, even though it's 2016, because we should even define escapist. I mean, obviously when I watch that show, say, I'm trying to think of a really violent one. Rome was a good show back in HBO when it was on, right?
I love
it.
Rome. That was my
show.
Favorite
It was very, very violent, very sexual. I'm sorry?
Yep.
You know, it was violent, it was sexual, you know, but I don't
violent,
want to...
sexual, I mean, what's kind of interesting about something like the TV show Rome is when you compare it to movies from, like, 1920s, 30s that had settings in ancient Roman times or biblical settings, it was kind of an excuse to sneak in a lot of sex and violence. You know, you would have Cecil B. DeMille or, you know, respectable filmmakers doing these Bible epics where it was kind of an excuse to throw in a little bit of nudity or people being tossed to lions because it was considered an acceptable arena for that kind of content.
Right. I mean, how can I say this other than bluntly? We're all adults here on the show, I'm hoping. Is
right.
I'm whatever I am, and I have a hard day at work, right? And I can go and say maybe pay my nickel, which at the time is probably a lot of money. I can see a biblical show and see maybe a naughty bitch from some girl being tossed in the line, knowing that when I get home, most likely I'm not going to see anything from my wife. You know?
Right.
And we had the same thing today. How many times does the Joe's public turn on late night TV knowing that, well, he ain't going to get anything tonight, he might as well watch one titty film or another titty film?
Well, it's funny now, it's TV, there's more freedom than films because you still have, we don't have the Hays Code anymore that sort of evaporated in 1950s with guys like Preminger and Hitchcock going against it, but instead we have the MPAA rating system in the States where it's technically self-regulation, but there are economic reasons why film would want to be PG-13 instead of R-rated, for instance, and if you have NC-17 film, that's commercial kiss of death. So now you see incredibly graphic stuff on cable television, but you won't necessarily see that in the movies or an average movie.
No, I think today would be different. I mean, CBS isn't going to run something most likely that doesn't have full frontal nudity, but you certainly can see it in HBO because now, at least, in my opinion, and it would be hard prove me wrong on this, I think I could be, but I think I'm right, is that I don't think too many films suffer the box office because they have an R rating or even at times an NC-17 rating.
Don't do well at the box office? Or
No, that's what we're told. We're told they don't do well. I don't think that's the case. But again, we're kind of getting away, kind of ahead of ourselves, but it's an interesting conversation because fact of the matter, people want to see the films they want to see.
Right.
And I see the Hays Code as a way of telling Joe Public, no, we don't want you to see these naughty films. We want you to be good public and see the films we approve of, and here they are.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you look at the people who are pressuring for it to be enforced. It's a relatively small group of people who are very loud. You know, we have the same thing today. It's not necessarily a majority who encourages this kind of censorship, but sometimes they're very vocal and vociferous, which is how these things get pushed through.
Absolutely. It's the people who will take to the streets, the rightful letters, make the phone calls. You know, the squeaky wheel sort of thing. Absolutely.
Right.
Well, we see that today, don't we ever. But even at the time, I mean, when I look at films, I love early period, I love early Hollywood films because, to me, in my opinion, that they're telling the story, a story that the public wants to hear, and at the same time, the stars are so weird with their behavior, we have that personal gratification. My life might suck, but I'm not going to court yet again because they think I killed a girl with a coke bottle.
Oh,
did you hear
sorry,
me, sir?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Sorry, it was a little bit hard to hear for a moment.
I'm sorry. I was saying, sir, you know, back in the day, I can see a film and get my personal gratification because I'm seeing whatever, right? At the same time, I can live vicariously through someone else, knowing that, like Freddie Eisbuckle, I'm not on trial yet again. Right? I think he went to trial twice for the supposed killing of Virginia rape, right?
I think, like, ultimately he was cleared, but there were, I mean, Hollywood was sort of notorious. The personal
yeah.
lives of many of these stars were considered scandalous. I think initially when the Hays Code crackdown came, there was like a list of 125 stars that were meant to be discouraged from being on the screen because their lives were considered too immoral. But I don't know
really?
How that worked out. Yeah.
I to get a list of that because we all heard of the blacklist of the 50s, right?
Right.
I did not know that other list because that would be interesting to look into those people, what they did. Oh, yeah. Thank you. I did not know that. See, Martin, you are a genius in film. That's why we only look for the best when you're a member of the Men of Milwaukee. We deliver the best content we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next up on our list, when we talk about the Hays Code, what were some of the things that they did not want you to see anymore?
Some of the things that were censored out of it?
Yes, sir.
I mean, a lot of it was sexual content. That seems to be the big sticking point. You know, it's usually you can trace a lot of the censorship back to good old-fashioned prudishness, but, you know, homosexuality, lesbianism, but even stuff that seems fairly tame, like husband and wife being in the same bed. You know, you watch films from post-crackdown, like 1934 films. I think the Thin Man movies with William Powell and Myrna Loy, they sleep in separate beds, which is, of course, ridiculous. But it's like they had to destroy even the basic insinuation that sex could happen. Blasphemous content, too, I know was a big one. I actually have a copy of the Hays Code. Some of the phrasing is so ridiculous, actually. You know, dancing. There was restrictions on dancing, on the locations where you could tell your stories. If there was a place of sexual sin, it was considered restricted and taboo. You know, films had to punish criminals. That was a big one. You know, you couldn't tell stories about people robbing a bank and getting away with it. They had to get machine gunned by the end of it.
Right, yeah,
to
right.
the point where, like, a lot of films, it was almost ridiculous where you can tell they sort of didn't want to end their stories that way, but you would have some kind of almost the opposite of a deus ex machina come in and punish these characters just because they had to be punished. That was part of the way these films were run. You know, if you're going to show some kind of criminal life or some sort of lurid depiction, these movies often had to have some kind of statement within the film that somehow condemned it, that made it seem okay to depict in the first place. But in general, it was pretty restrictive.
Right, especially the idea that crime could not pay.
Right, that was the big one. Which is, like, one thing I love about the pre-code films, especially, like, you say pre-code, it kind of includes silent era, but mostly when you say pre-code, you think from the beginning of sound up till 1934, so it's like 1929 to 1934, but I kind of love the amorality of so many of those films, the cynicism. You know, there's a film we might talk about tomorrow, Night Nurse, which... it's great. Barbara Stanwyck falls in love with a gangster, and at the end he murders the bad guy, and they drive off, and they're happily ever after. I think it's exhilarating to see that kind of break from the traditional morality that you usually see in these types of movies.
I think it's interesting, too, that a lot of this comes after, right around the time of the Great Depression, when society
right.
is undergoing such upheaval. I think that perhaps people wrongly assumed that if these movies were out there where the bad guys could get by with something, we would see a string of bank robberies. Because after all, it seemed that Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, and others,
mm-hmm.
Pretty Boy Floyd, were doing those things and getting away with it. Why can't I?
It's Do you know the film that Dillinger saw immediately before he was murdered? Before he was shot?
I don't.
Manhattan Melodrama with Clark Gable and William Powell and Myrna Loy. I think it's maybe W.F. Van Dyke who directed it. And that's all about this two guys who came up together. One became successful and the other one became a criminal. And at the end, he's sent off to be executed. So it's sort of interesting to see how the films that were being made at that time reflected, like you said, real life criminals like Dillinger, who were famous really at the times when these films were being cranked out. You had films, I think, like The Public Enemy, that was made while many of these gangsters,
yep,
bootleggers were active. It's not a history piece. It was a current event.
It was current event.
You see James Cagney with the Tommy gun.
I mean, it was. Even at the time, you have things, the horrific acts like St. John's Massacre, right? You had some really, really vicious gang wars going on in New York and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that the typical everyday person was not being killed in a drive-by shooting. That was not the case. But a typical everyday person knew someone they could buy liquor from. They knew someone who was loan sharking money. They knew someone who was on the take. You know, it's
like
the temptation.
I think Valentine's Day Massacre, that's 1929, right?
I believe
people
so,
like
yes,
Al Capone
sir.
Were still on the rise while these gangster films were being made.
Yeah. And the temptation is, I mean, if we don't, how can I put this? Perhaps at the time, because they're dead, we can't ask them. Perhaps they thought that if we can convince the public that crime does not pay, it's a lot cheaper to do it that way than it is to do it some other way, whatever that way it might be.
Right. I mean, a lot of these people, they had sort of a reputation almost like folk heroes. But, I mean, that was the basic idea, is that these films, they were corrupting American values. They had to be stopped at all costs.
That's wild. I think it's wild. I mean, we kind of see that even with some of the other propaganda, like Reefer Mandis, when the war on hemp and cannabis started, right? It was, what can we do? What methods of propaganda can we come up with to stop this?
Right.
You know,
I mean, it's always been true that if you can manipulate media, you can impact people. And some are obviously more skillful at that than others. But, I mean, it's also a big reflection of where the culture is. And you do see these sort of returns to authoritarianism and returns to more restrictive morals. Like, I mean, we're talking primarily about America, but I think at the same time you had in Europe, films being made in the Weimar Republic were very, also very dark and sexual and cynical and subversive. You know, you had films like Pandora's Box with Louise Brooks or Blue Angel with Marlene Dietrich. And then almost around the same time as the production code cracked down, you had a rise of fascism and the end of the Weimar Republic and, you know, became Nazi propaganda. So it went from one extreme to the other.
Well, absolutely. And it's fascinating you bring that up, because we can't pass this prologue, right? We tend to repeat ourselves.
Right.
And we see it now where, wasn't that long ago, that I could freely take a thing I made for my cable TV station. I used to run the place, I should know. I could put it on, nobody said two things. And the first thing our city government did to make morale better was to control what could be seen, because after all, if we saw show the video of this guy selling drugs at the street corner, people in Chaffin downtown were seen because they think it's unsafe. Versus doing something about the drug problem, we'd simply control what people can see.
Right. People sort of feel like if they're not seeing depictions of it, then the problem's not there.
It's not there. That's right. We can control the horizontal sort of thing, right? But yet, it's in my opinion, what I really like about the pre-cold film, when I talk to my children, my grandchildren, my extended family, and other people that are involved in dying with history or film and the like, is by looking at these films, what they depict pre-code, we can also see what people are interested in. They're interested
right.
in me. They're seeing these movies because this is what they're interested in seeing for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, it was during the Depression. So one thing that you see that was very popular with these stories about people finding success, you know, relying on their own abilities, taking success by force, not, you know, none of these films were about people winning lotteries, really, you know, but you watch a film like some of these gangster films, it's all about people climbing their way to the top, or even something like Babyface with Barbara Stanwyck. It's all sort of about her using her own sexuality to find success. And there's like this, you know, Nietzschean dialogue that she can take control over her own life. I think there was a real, very American desire to find success through individualistic means that was quite clear in those pre-code films and the desires
right.
you see
oh,
reflected
absolutely.
In them. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's really nice because, I'll put this, I don't think the way to assess is become a gangster, unless, of course, you work for the government. That being
right.
said, I think it's a very appealing to the people of the late 20s, early 30s, going through
right.
such harsh economic times, that there's hope if you try your best, that you know how to do, use the tools that you have available, that the sky is still the limit, right? That if you, you know,
right.
you might want to be. I mean, I'm a bit older than you, I hate to say, but
right.
My grandfather was run moonshine in the 40s, right? He did
mm-hmm.
late 30s, early 40s. That's how he made money for his family. He did what it took, right?
Right.
People tend to, and he didn't do it because he saw it in the movie theater. He saw it because he had to do it. He knew the people to talk to. It's the idea that you can't really control through censorship ideas, information that people have, yet we tend to want to do that.
Well, like I'm from Czech Republic. Like my father, when he was growing up in the 60s, like censorship was a huge part of it. You know, especially in 1968, you know, almost completely destroyed the film culture during the Soviet invasion. But, you know, he was growing up at a time when there were films that were banned for life or banned because a food fight showed the wasteful depiction of food, things like that. You know, you
yeah.
see it in other places and other times. And, you know, I think we're always maybe at risk of that kind of censorship coming back into it. Although it's interesting too, you know, thinking about Czech New Wave film and comparing it to post-code Hollywood films, you see artists find a way anyway to get their ideas out. And when you look
mm-hmm.
at films after the code came in, instead of films being explicit about sexuality or their morality or whatever, it's kind of pushed down into the subtext of those films. You know, all of a sudden people weren't explicit about their ideas, but there's all these innuendos and all these insinuations, and a smart person could definitely pick up on them. And, you know, I don't know if you have that many smart people on the censorship board who could understand that maybe there are ideas getting through that go directly against what they're trying to enforce.
And one thing I've noticed living in the inner city and talking to minority kids and using films to get messages across, right? I do like
mm-hmm.
Animal Farm a lot. It does do such a good job with socialism. I love it to death. You don't have to be. I got to watch my language here. The 14-year-old boy down the street, you know, kid down the street, understands what Animal Farm is about. You don't have to lecture them. They get the message. They understand subtext in a film. They understand double entendre. It doesn't take rocket
right.
science. It's something we learn growing up, language, because there's a spoken language and there's body language, and there's all kinds of hidden meanings of words. I think people, at least I don't know everything about, but I understand that it's there. And you can't censor that out of the film, and a good filmmaker, a good media creator knows how to put it in.
Right.
I think
that's Milos Forman, it was like a big deal trying to get his film Fireman's Ball banned. They had to some kind of a screening. He said, like, the censors, they said, like, they couldn't pick out any specific thing that was wrong, but they knew they didn't like it. They knew there was something that they couldn't pinpoint that was in the subtext of the film that was against their values. So I think it was the same way in the, you know, 1930s and 40s Hollywood. And that's also around the same time you see the rise of these film noir films, which were incredibly cynical and often incredibly violent and sexual in a more implicit way than some of the pre-code films.
Well, yes. And one thing I'm sure we'll get into when we talk about the films themselves is those hidden meanings and the stars in them, because I'm thinking the more you brought up those, you said 150 names of people that Hollywood didn't want to be in films anymore, or the Hays Code people
right.
didn't want to be in films anymore, is I wonder if we look at them, because time goes on, they don't get roles, the different stars that come up are simply are equally morally corrupt, right? Freddie Arbuckle Club does go away from film, but you have other people take their place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we can talk for days on the number of corrupt filmmakers and the number of weird, kinky, crazy film stars.
Well, I mean, I think the often the censors, like Joseph Breen, were often hypocrites themselves. You know, but it's
yeah. Well, right on.
I think like
right
W.S. Van Dyke, who did the Manhattan melodrama and the Thin Man films, supposedly he even punched out Breen when he had some kind of an argument in a bar, but because Breen mangled one of his films. I don't know. There's going to be a lot to get into once we talk more about specific films. And I mean, all these stars that came out of that era, it's interesting who sort of moved on to more respectable things. But
I mean, Hollywood.
No,
Hollywood,
I'm sure we're going to have names like Clark Gable and Gene Harlow and Garbo all come up, yeah.
And all great people. I mean, you look at Marilyn Dietrich, right? She
right.
gets a bad rap because supposedly she was somewhat of a Nazi, supposedly in 3, because she went to the American commanders to make sure her brother didn't go to jail. But yet, during the Second World War, she entertained the troops. She was near the front lines doing it. She gave up one of her fortunes to help refugees. As Americans back here criticizing her, I'm sorry?
Sure. Like, you look at your actual biography, it's hard to find somebody who is more anti-Nazi. And that was at a time when Hollywood, in general, wasn't anti-Nazi. Like, before America was involved in the war, like, the general sentiment was we should mind our own business, you know, and people who were opposing Hitler and the rise of Nazism were considered provocateurs or, you know, causing trouble that had nothing to do with America. And you see how quickly that flipped, but it's sort of funny, you know. Chaplin's Great Dictator was considered controversial for making fun of Hitler, which is completely ridiculous, but
I'm sorry, my little friend the English lady says it run up against the clock, but we'll bring you the second chapter of this great show tomorrow at the same bat time. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Mr. Icepick. It's an honor and a privilege to have you on the show, and please release my family members. I hope I'm not upset you too much in the show.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, and I'm looking forward to following this up tomorrow.
All right, thank you, sir. Have fun, everybody, and remember, watch out with those Tommy guns. Bye.